is the exactly what I'm working on and fussing about, which is the truth of the Tathagata's words. So let me tell you about my journey. I've had a lifelong concern with what is true. This is a yeasty combination of parents, having grown up with parents who were devoted to pretty pictures, covering or hiding much that was not pretty. And then, as relief from that, hours spent in the complex reality of nature outside our rural Michigan doors. And so I escaped from all that stuff and so getting to what true is true for me has an edge. The fury of a child who suffered in the midst of pretty talk, and the inspiration of the miracle that life is, which is of course what one finds when one goes outside and sits and watches and participates in a sense in what's going on out in nature. And a great deal, as you know, goes on. So once immersed in Buddhism, this has led me to explore what is known and understood about the origins of our Buddhism. I'm concerned with what was Buddha's actual history and what did he actually say, instead of what was later said about his life or attributed by him to him by others. I've heard a lot of pretty fantastic stuff and said to myself, that can't possibly be true. It can't possibly be that we know tiny, tiny details of what he felt and thought. How could we? And can't be that those things that are said to have happened could possibly have happened. Some of the things that are said happened. As with all religions, there's a lot of pretty fantastic stuff, and we are not immune from that in Buddhism. But of course, you can probably already hear the edge in my voice. There's this edge of the old emotional reaction. And so I work and work and work on trying to investigate this whole exploration of what do we know? What can we possibly know about what the Buddha's life was, and what can we know about what his teachings were? And so I ask you to notice when I go over the edge a bit, and when I seem to be playing with it in a rather safer and saner way. I've been very taken with the work of Stephen Batchelor, and I realize that that there's a lot of criticism and upset about his work. But one thing that I've found very, very interesting is he took an extended trip to India to follow the Buddha's path and to try to discover what he could about his life, from whatever one could discover now. And he studied the geographical terrain and the history of that terrain, and somehow figured out that that north road on which the Buddha walked to give his teachings is about 8 feet under the ground now, because it's in a river basin, and the river comes and the sediment comes, and the mountains have been giving off their water every year. And so what was standing, what he was walking on, is long, long lost deeply under the ground. And he also investigated some of the old sites which are known to have contained the Buddha's relics, and found and came to understand that the first relics were found and distributed throughout the world, and then the next group of archaeologists came along and dug deeper, 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 and found more relics, or fewer relics, but a whole other set, you know. So it is an incredibly remote history, and Many would say that my quest is absolutely impossible. You cannot know something that happened so very, very, very long ago. On the other hand, there are numbers who say that we can. But to me, this storytelling connects strongly, powerfully with our Buddhist precepts. The one that most resonates with me with this problem is that a disciple of the Buddha does not take that which is not given. So to me, if a story is not an actual early story, my ethical compass points away from using it as if it was. We might say, we don't know. We think this is the best impression that we can have based on what it is, that this is the real story of the Buddha's life, or the real depiction of what his teachings were. Clearly we can't know for sure. But there, I've been discovering some extremely interesting work that helps us to know some things about his life and about his teachings. But you know, there are Buddhist teachers I've heard in the last year even who tell Buddhist fables as if they are true stories of the Buddha's life. It's not an uncommon thing in Buddhism in 2013 that stories are told as if they're true when there's no hints of precursors to these stories in the early materials. So I get, you know, kind of upset when that happens. But that is, and I realize other people don't get upset, so this is my deal, but this is the deal that I'm sharing with you. Now, I'm wondering sometimes if I'm just more naive than other students of Buddhism. Do you all, when you hear those stories, you say, oh yeah, yeah, that's a story. It's a story to give us inspiration. It's a story to point out something that's an important truth. It sharpens the past much more than it could possibly be sharpened, but it tells us this important truth, that teaching that the teacher is hoping that we will know. And perhaps everybody but me got that deal. When I heard teachers telling me those stories, I said, oh, that's the story. And then came to find that there were other stories and that some of those pretty fantastic stories were not true. There's a current teacher of Buddhism, Rita Gross, who has pointed this out really beautifully in articles in Tricycle magazine, that in a way to try to cut through just to the empirically true in any faith, and certainly in our faith, is to miss those teachings that are very inspirational and lead us to understand something that is not so very concrete. So of course one has to be careful not to miss out on those kinds of teachings. One of the stories that particularly bothers me is when I hear a teacher saying that the Buddha was the son of a king. Has anyone else ever heard that story? The Buddha was the son of a king? Yeah. The Buddha was not the son of a king. There is a lot, gradually more and more and more understanding of that time. And the Buddha was the son of a tribal leader who lived in a realm where another person was king. And I'm going to read a little bit from Stephen Batchelor about that. I'm sure that what people are trying to say when they say this, if they even have a realization that it's not true, is they're trying to say he was born in a very rarefied atmosphere. He was born to a very powerful father. He was isolated from a lot of ordinary life. When he left that realm and went to wander as a mendicant, to practice in the woods, to give up all those worldly goods, this was a very, very major denunciation of the really riches, worldly riches that he had. But I think if they tell the real story, which is that he was the son of a tribal leader, he still was, you know, giving up a lot. He just wasn't the son of a king. And so, being me, I ask, what do we know about what's earliest? What is closest to what the Buddha was likely to have taught? And apparently I've found that I'm joining a tradition that's of which Stephen Batchelor is one teacher, and it's called Basic Buddhism. I didn't know this thing had a name, but Stephen Batchelor has given it a name. And I think that it's a relatively new tradition in Buddhism. So in my own journey, I first asked, what were the earliest written materials that survive to this day, and what do they reveal? And the Pali Canon was written down in Sri Lanka about 500 AD and represented, as we were told, texts that were memorized and repeated by the early Theravadan Buddhists. It's long been considered the complete and accurate rendition of early Buddhist teachings. Now, sometimes you hear that those are the Buddhist teachings, that is the only tradition, that all early Buddhists repeated these same teachings, and those were the ones that got written down in Sri Lanka, and that's what we have. In fact, there have been other early manuscripts found that are the remnants, that are the written down remnants of the oral history, the oral teachings of other traditions in early India. So there were a number of different traditions repeating their own, with a lot of commonality, but repeating their own teachings that eventually got written down. The thing that caused me trouble in the Pali Canon was this kind of very fantastic imagery of layers of heavens into the sky and thousands, millions of people listening to the Buddha, and really pretty amazing, fantastic things happening that I said can't be true. It's just too fantastic. And so I wanted to know more about what in the Pali Canon might have been early, what might have been the written accounts of the materials that the Buddha really taught. And I found a couple of sources that are really interesting, and it's a lot of material, so if you find that you're interested in what some of these sources are and want to get into them yourselves, I'm happy to take your email address and forward you the links to these things. I went searching on the internet, how fortunate we are to have that, and came across a really lovely article by someone named Dharmakari Nagapriya. That's the name that was given, and it was a big mystery who this person was. Have you heard of this person? It's not a published article, but it's beautiful, beautiful, fascinating, helpful article. And so I've been on this detective search for this guy, and this is the kind of name that's given to people who have, I don't know whether you'd say, kind of like taken the precepts or maybe become teachers in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. So that is the strand that he teaches in, and he talks eloquently about the Sutta Nipata as the oldest part of the Pali Canon. And he reveals which parts, according to his study and the study of others like Pandey, who he quotes, are the earliest ones. And he has very, very interesting things to say about the parts that are earliest. The parts that he claims are earliest are the parts that speak to my heart. They're not fantastic. They're powerful prescriptions for how to lead an ethical life, how to lead a life that respects the way things really are in nature, the life, the complex interaction of reality, such as one a little child can find in a Michigan field, and such that all of us as we go out in our lives can experience is happening. The Metta Sutta, which is really a guide for my every moment of every day, is part of the Sutta Nipata, and it's part of those teachings that Dharma, Kari, Naga, Priya considers to be early. Although there are other analysts who say that there's no evidence that the Buddha ever spoke in verse, that most of the evidence of these early writings is that he came to a place and someone asked him a question and he spoke, or he asked a question and spoke. So this verse business is probably one of his disciples, probably somebody who accompanied him there very early, perhaps put in verse at the time of the Buddha, perhaps put in verse slightly later, but very, very early. And that would be the Metta Sutta being one. I'll think of the other one in a minute. Dhammapada, thank you, Patrick. Yes, another beautiful favorite that has these verses that guide our lives. So I found this the work, quite amazing work, of a professor, N.A. Jayawikrama. This is a name I've been carrying around with me for years now, Jayawikrama. He was did his University of London doctoral thesis in 1947, which he took line by line of the Sutta Nipata and did an analysis of what in it was early and what in it was later. And it is serialized. It was first of all serialized in the Ceylon University Review and then again in the Pali Buddhist Review in the 1970s. And you can get it for free online. You can download it into your own computers. It's extremely tough going, line by line of this stuff, but a very sophisticated analysis, not just on what the language was like. Did the language seem like an early way of expressing in Pali, or did it seem like a more complicated later way of expressing? Because I had the opportunity to talk all this stuff over with Gil Fronsdell, who's a Zen Buddhist teacher as well as a Vipassana teacher, and he said, you know, you can't believe it based on the linguistic analysis only, because somebody could have been trying to make it sound as if it was the early teachings. So they could have written it in that old form of expression. So that's not something, you know, which, I mean, I think I'd like to count on it, but I think we have to be warned that we need other corroborating evidence to make sure that those eloquent, simpler ways of expressing were really the earlier material. So Jayawikrama asked whether the Sutta Nipata was done in gradual stages or whether it was the work of a single editor. And so he followed the linguistic kind of analysis that had already been done, and which had shown that some of the passages were written in an earlier and some in a later form of the Pali language. But he went further than this, and he compared the language in the Sutta Nipata to what's known of other languages in use at the time and other early Buddhist manuscripts. So he did a rather thoroughgoing analysis of what, and studied the stories in the Sutta Nipata and compared them to what's known of society in different periods. I mean, it was pretty thoroughgoing analysis, and I don't begin to understand all of it. When I grew up, there was a saying, an ad slogan that I was better living through chemistry. And now my slogan is often, you can figure it all out using Excel. So I imagine a very complicated Excel spreadsheet where every section of the Sutta Nipata is in the first column, and then I take Jayawikrama's analysis of that, and then this other person and his, and on and on and on. It's going to be very hard. You have to have a very big screen to encompass this. But that's kind of, as I go along, you'll see some of the materials that are really inspiring me to go to the Sutta Nipata and follow this analysis through and ask the same questions myself and see if I believe the answers that have been given. I should be.
Did you bring any of the early teachings from the Sutta Nipata?
No, no. I'm really just talking about the journey. I mean, I know that would be beautiful. I mean, you could say, okay, the Metta Sutta would be one that we all, I hope, have in our hearts or going to have in our hearts. So I was so excited when I heard that some new Buddhist manuscripts had been discovered, buried deep in the ground in the ruins of an old monastery in what's now Afghanistan, in the Gandharan region. I thought, oh, here we go. This is what I've been waiting for, because these most early manuscripts are going to give us the answer to my question. What's in them, you know? And it was a little complicated to get my hands on the beautiful books that had been, the books were several volumes at $60 each, and there's no way you could tell whether they were really going to be useful, so I was very hesitant to just order them. So I waited till I got into a library and got my hands on them and sat down and looked. And it was quite wonderful. If you can see on Wikipedia has some of the photos from these books, which show that they it was written on birch bark, and they were wrapped around and put in stone urns and then buried deep in the ground. So then they brought this brittle birch bark out and laid it out. Imagine white sheets on big tables. And they had to crack it, because how else could they get it and read it? So they have photos of these cracked pieces in sequence. And then there were maybe two or three people in the world today prepared to read this stuff. A man at University of Washington in Seattle somehow believed that there were going to come manuscripts and that it was worth his while to learn this language. There were other things he could read, but not much. And then he was ready. These things got cracked and laid out, and he could start to work on it, and also people in England started to work on it. So I was pretty psyched that I was going to learn the stuff from this. And it turned out that these beautiful, huge books that they've published so far are primarily scholarly works on the problems of translating cracked pieces of birch bark. Kind of, in a way, inspirational, but not what I was searching for. So my sense is I have to wait. To wait quite a while until they finish their work with these manuscripts, and then they can write something that somebody with a beautiful gift for writing in English will then translate, so that you and I can read those Gandharan manuscripts. But they did contain the Metta Sutta, they contained the Dhammapada, they contained the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta, which is also, these things are also in the Sutta Nipata. So they did contain familiar materials, and they contained materials that were familiar from also early manuscripts that survive only in Chinese. So that was kind of confirming. They also were the kinds of recitation materials that monks would use in a monastery to recite the teachings. So they were clearly those kinds of materials that would be used by the monks who used them and buried them. So I turned to the work of Stephen Batchelor and his fascinating book called Confession of a Buddhist Atheist. It's I highly recommend it. It's very readable. It's a tale of Batchelor's own Buddhist journey, which is very, very interesting. And it's also his study of the Pali Canon to discern which of the teachings were in Buddha's own voice and which were not. And he studied history and to make sense of the period. So I thought I'd read just a tiny, tiny bit about what he found. One of the greatest obstacles to understanding the Buddha's life is the story that Buddhism traditionally tells of it. In this well-known version, Prince Siddhartha was born as the son and heir of King Suddhodana and was raised in the luxury of royal palaces in the kingdom of Sakya. One day, curious to know more about the realm over which he one day would rule, he made an excursion beyond the palace walls and for the first time encountered a sick person, an aging person, a corpse, and a wandering monk. We all know this story, right? Yeah. These sights shocked the spoiled young man into an awareness of his own mortality. Unable any longer to lead the idle and sensuous life of a young prince, he fled the palace at night, discarded his luxurious robes and jewels, shaved his head, and became a wandering monk. After 6 years of strenuous meditation and asceticism, he sat beneath the Bodhi tree and realized awakening, and thus became the Buddha, the awakened one. Now, this account contradicts what we know about Siddhartha Gautama in the Pali Canon. The Buddha's father was not a king, but a leading nobleman of the Gautama clan, who would have served as chairman of the assembly in Sakya. At most, he would have been a sort of regional headsman or governor. Sakya was part of the powerful kingdom of Kosala, ruled by King Pasenadi from the capital city of Savatthi, about 80 miles to the west. The Sakyans are vassals of the king of Kosala, acknowledged Siddhartha Gautama. They offer him humble service and salute him, rise and do him homage and pay him fitting service. And although the story of the four sights is related by Gautama in one of the Pali discourses, it forms part of a mythical tale about another Buddha called Vipassi, who lived in the distant past. The story has nothing to do with Gautama himself. So if you follow my journey, you have to give up a lot of the well-known stories. And there's a number of those opportunities in reading that book. And there are a lot of people who are not so happy with Stephen Batchelor and his work, so there's also that. More recently, I've been reading the works of Richard Gombrich, who is a scholar at University of Oxford in England, and he's written a number of books. He's a student of India and also of Sanskrit and Pali and Buddhist studies. He knows, he's able to read in the original the later written down works of Jainism and Hinduism as well as Buddhism. So he's taken it upon himself to compare that literature. And as Batchelor convincingly and also Gombrich point out, Buddha was very familiar with the teachings of these other religions too. And he was in conversation with them. And he used often their words, their language, their terms, and gave them new meanings. They were the religious words available at the time, and they were the ones that he used. And they give very interesting examples of the way he turned those terms and made them his own or our own. So Gombrich is a modern scholar, and people tell him this stuff is too remote. You can't possibly know it. You're doing an impossible job. And his approach is what he calls experimental. And that is, he studies all of the materials and a lot of materials beyond Buddhism, and then writes down and proposes what he considers to be the most accurate, best story he can tell about these things, and then asks others to tell him he's wrong. Present him with evidence that says that that another way of telling the story is better. So in a way, it's a kind of more liberal approach that I'm trying to get used to, because in a way, you can't know. In a way, I was hoping for early writings that would give more definition. But there's this realm of recent scholarship, which is kind of convincing me that you have to give up the thought that you could ever for sure know, but that there are careful ways of studying all the wonderful things that we have and coming to understand what is. So that's going to be, those ways are going to be the basis for this killer of all Excel spreadsheets that may happen. So there's a lot that I was thinking about telling you about what Gombrich was saying, but I'm thinking that it would be much more fun in a minute to do something else. So it's a great gift that Kokyo has given me to be asked to tell you the story of my explorations into the basis of early Buddhist teachings. In my head, these are the things that I'm concerned about. And simultaneously with that, my body is learning to bow unmolested with these thoughts and to rise and follow the sound of the bell, another story that's beginning to unfold. And so I'm curious about what you're thinking. Do these matters concern you? What are you thinking? Yes?
Could you tell us where we could go online to see the Birch book, manuscripts, the photographs?
Well, Wikipedia has really a beautiful, pretty complete article. And then there is a website out of University of Washington, Seattle.
Under what heading?
A Gandharan Buddhist manuscripts. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that gets you to that website too. But if it doesn't, you can leave me your email and I'll find it again and send it to you. Yes.
I really enjoyed what you had to say. I'm reminded there are a lot of things that I was thinking about as you were talking. One is that Judaism has had a very similar struggle. There's something you might be familiar with. There's some manuscripts discovered in the Middle East that slightly differed from contemporary accounts of certain rules that Judaism had and things like that, and caused a recontemplation. There's also a very small group of Jews called Karaites who live in Israel, and they are very against relatively contemporary interpretations of these very, very old, you know, thousand-year-old texts. In particular, there's something called the Talmud, which are all interpretations and laws that people created after they were reading kind of the Torah and the Old Testament. So for me, it's deeply interesting because they sometimes come to different conclusions. And I personally have this conviction that sometimes these secondary interpretations create authority that is sometimes not deserved and sometimes it's even abused in Judaism. For example, there's an area called Kashrus, which is a kosher law. It's what one is supposed to eat and what not.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes this creates trouble to my, you know, ethical sort of sensibilities, because sometimes they don't cut to the core of the issue. For example, I could get a little more into this, but they kind of forget what was originally said.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm not saying too much, but also when you mentioned Gombrich, I'm reminded of something that happened to me 2 weeks ago when I was camping, actually. It sounds like totally unrelated, but when one puts together a tent, you have these, you know, two long sort of metal poles. And if you sort of stare at them, one argument I think is it's kind of a little bit difficult to see how it comes together unless you've seen somebody else put it together. But then when you kind of, then you see that they kind of bend. And what I'm reminded with the Gombrich situation is, on the one hand, one can argue that one can't know the past, but on the other hand, within the context of these texts, I think certain words are defined and illuminated, just like kind of putting together a little tent. You don't sort of realize ahead of time until you do this sort of experiment. Of course, the parallel of that is one can find, you know, dozens of things to do with these sticks with this tent that might create something entirely different. But
who puts up tents, I totally, that's a beautiful, a beautiful analogy. You know, the same thing is with the Christian documents, and it's so very interesting. It's the same deal in all these old religions, you know, that new manuscripts are found and they reveal new stories, and each of them probably have some old, some newer in them. I mean, people had audiences that they wanted to give this good news to. I mean, this, our Buddhism is good news. It really helps people, I think, to hear these teachings. And so they were certainly faced with people in India who were steeped in Hinduism, who were used to these fantastic stories that Hinduism teaches. And so if we gave them fantastic stories, maybe then they would catch our good news a little more clearly or readily. So it's understandable how materials get changed as they go through time. And it's in, I mean, at least certainly Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism. I don't know what's happened in Jainism, etc., but I'm assuming that this is what happens. Anybody? Yeah.
Thank you for your reflections. What you've been talking about reminds me of a distinction I've heard in other places, a distinction between truth and fact. And the art of storytelling has been described, I've heard it described as creating worlds that are more truth than fact. And so part of what interests me, or I often think about these stories in this way, of creating worlds that are more truth often than fact. But one of the great things about historical study and the attempt to sort of clutter away some of the non-fact and get to some of the fact is the dimensions of the truth that it can open for us that we might have been missing previously. That multiplying dimensions of the truth actually can bring the truth much closer to our experience, which is very ambivalent and multiple. So with all that backdrop, I'm wondering whether there are any particular truths that have stuck with you that have come out of your tireless really ambitious search for facts. And in this case, are there any new sort of truth discoveries that have come out for you in some of the study that you've done of the text or anything else like that that you might share?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to say that it's really what Rita Gross was also speaking to in those Tricycle articles, you know, that if we need to get just down to that bare bones, defendable truth, then we miss some of the inspiration. I just want people to tell the truth about truth. Tell me you're telling me an inspirational story, and that this is a story that's come down to us, and we have no idea whether it's true or not, but it inspires us. Fine. I mean, am I the only one who needs to be reminded of that? I usually think I share some of experience with others, you know. I mean, I have a buddy from when I lived at Zen Center who got really angry with me on the phone that I was carrying on like this, because didn't I know that those were just stories? Like, I should have recognized that. Well, cool. She was really smarter than I was. So there's that. I think for me, the simpler the teachings, the stronger I've taken them in, the more strongly I've taken them in. So the teaching that everything is connected to everything else and everything changes, that everything is completely interdependent, you know, that is complicated but simple. And that means so much to me to see the world that way. To the things that crop up in your daily life, that to stop and say, oh, rather than reacting, which is not always what I do, sometimes I react too, but that stop and say, oh, and allow space for the knowing of the causes beyond imagination. This is not this person doing this thing, but this is so multiply caused that we can't imagine it, except we can kind of imagine that the causes are beyond our imagination. And that, all these people who talk about what's early, that teaching was powerful and early. You know, the teachings about leading an ethical life and how living in accord with the what we now have as the precepts is a precursor to living peacefully and deeply with all of everything in life. That was also early, early. And I think that's, to me, deeply true, and I appreciate, you know, every time turn another page and someone says, yes, that was early. You know, there was this man walking this road, this dusty road, you know, and talking to people, and they gathered around him. We believe that was true. And I believe that that what he was telling was very powerful and very clear. And it wasn't, you know, long lists of words with complicated meanings that you have to, like, really work your head to, have I got it, you know? But they were these deeply important, simple, clear truths. And, you know, if I have the energy to devote and the years that it's going to take me to do this work, to keep on doing this work, maybe I will find out more about that was true or that it wasn't true. You know?
Okay.
Well, I think some of the things that came up already are some thoughts that I've had about, you know, what's inspirational and what's actually helpful, kind of evolving skillful means to benefit beings, whether or not it was the word of Buddha. But I think one point that came up also, problem with, if it wasn't really the Buddha teaching, is there's like some dogma that's created and is used for like political reasons and so on. Later, and I think probably there's some theories about that maybe some of the teachings that were like put the women nuns kind of maybe below the men, maybe those were added later for political reasons, and then they get attributed to the Buddha and become like kind of dogmatic teaching because the Buddha said it, so we can't change it, things like this. So I think that would be seems like one of the really practical, helpful reasons to look for these earliest teachings, because they maybe would discount, just like this story in Judaism that you were bringing up, they might undo some of the like dogmatic, that were like, it has to be this way because the Buddha said it. Maybe it didn't.
Yes, lots of people's lives are quite affected by
these
things.
Yeah, lines are affected, yeah.
Yeah.
And as I recall in those early teachings of the Sutta Nipata, there's a lot of, like you say, very simple, straightforward teachings about not holding particular views really strongly. Do you remember that? It seems like they're, instead of like how exactly you're working the mind, it's more like just don't hold any fixed views.
Mm-hmm.
Teachings like that. Mm-hmm. Sounded when I read them in the Sutta Nipata, I thought, this sounds like Zen.
Mm-hmm.
They're like really straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And Dogen's, aim was to get back to those early teachings. That's what he, the assignment he was giving himself.
And he might not have known all this research that's around now.
Well, yeah. Presumably not.
Yeah.
But had his own inspiration and sense. Yeah. Yeah. Shall we have tea or does anyone have another thought?
Just here briefly. So, in Christianity, it's the search for the historical Jesus. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Finding, new things and looking in the readings from Scripture and seeing if they are really what Jesus said or something that his disciples wrote down later that they added in that they thought was that same kind of thing. What I also kind of, went on a search through that stuff for a while to try to understand what was real and what wasn't real. For me, it was important because there were some things that just didn't, fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know whether it's my strong self-will that says, it doesn't make sense because I don't want it to make sense,
mm-hmm.
or it's because it wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
So for a person like me, that was an important search. I'm very interested to hear about this. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible.